back, WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We appreciate all of our great sponsors. Had a great dinner the other night at one of our new sponsors at Pappas, and I had it with my friend Leonard Raskin from Raskin Global, so a big shout-out to him, and you can find him and all of our wise conversations out at BaltimorePositive.com. You know, this one comes onto my desk, honestly. You know, I have so many old friends in the PR business, and so shout out to Chip Namius, who I saw a couple weeks ago at the Super Bowl, and always throws me great guests and books and authors and movie stars and just different people. And this one came to my desk, and I'm like, yeah, I want to do this one because it's interesting to me. We're coming up now, crazy enough, on the 60th anniversary. I was not on the planet when Wilt Chamberlain scored 100 points. My father talked about it. I think my father loved baseball, but basketball was probably my father's number two. My dad was born in 1919, so he loved the Bullets and loved the Knicks rivalry in the late 60s and early 70s and Gus and the Big E and all that kind of stuff. So anytime I could talk some old school NBA, it's more fun than new school NBA for me. Gary Pomerantz is here. He once wrote a book about Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point night, and because it happened up the road, it had Baltimore connections to it. And I'm going to let him tell the story because I love when I bring my uncles on here and they give me great stories and books and lore and all that. Gary, welcome. How are you? It's been a long time since you wrote the book. I mean, you know, like 60 years, we're getting up on something here, right?
Yeah, Wednesday is the 60th anniversary. It's good to be on your show, by the way. And I wrote this book. It came out 17 years ago. You know, this is one of the evergreens of sports. Wilt Chamberlain's 100-point game. And you know, ultimately, I conducted 250 interviews for this book. I interviewed more than 50 people who were there. And of course, as you know, a lot of people claim to have been there and weren't there. They claim to have been in Madison Square Garden the night Wilt scored 100 points, and he didn't do it in Madison Square Garden.
I had a basketball guy here in Baltimore who passed away a number of years ago, PB, who absolutely was at the game, sort of claim to fame. I think he had a ticket, like the whole deal, because there was a total Baltimore part to this, right, that makes this even more interesting than my dad recollecting it, or the fact that there's no video of it, and the fact that it feels Paul Bunyan-y, right? It feels like a tall tale. It, you know, it feels like Babe Ruth swatted 100 one year, or, you know, but 56 game, you know, hitting streak for DiMaggio, these sort of lore things. How any kid would say, how could someone score? Steph can't even score 100. You know, Michael couldn't score 100. How could someone score 100 points, especially when there was no 3-pointer?
Right. So Michael hit 63. Steph, he's gone as high as 62, Klay Thompson 60. That's a long way from 100. And you're right, this does have almost a fictional folk hero kind of quality to it. You know, like John Henry, the hammer in his hand, out pounding the steam drill. This was Wilt's night. You know, believe it or not, you know, it had been prophesied that one night he was going to score 100 points if the planets aligned. And this was the year, 1961, 62, when he averaged 50 points a game. And not only that, he averaged 48 and a half minutes played per game. Think about that, Nestor. 48. The games are
so he just took the ball down and stuffed it in, right, at that point.
No, he did not. That's not true. No, in fact, what the only electronic coverage, because there was no TV there that night, was WCAU radio in Philadelphia. Bill Campbell at the call. And all that exists from that call is the fourth quarter. And if you listen to the fourth quarter, as I have about 1,000 times, you hear him saying, you know, Wilt, fall away jumper, Wilt, put back, Wilt, in transition, even once, Wilt, from out near the top of the key. You know, what's he doing out here? Campbell says, he knows he's going for 1-0-0, and it's in a half-empty arena out in Amish country.
Well, this was the Hershey Park Arena, right?
Correct.
It's really weird to have you on because I had my friends from Wise Markets on. They're based up there. I was talking about going up to Hershey and seeing a Bears game. I was literally over the weekend thinking about it because, like, concerts are happening. You know, Hershey's got, like, the Motley Crue show going through. So I was like, I wonder when I'll be back. And I go to Hershey all the time for concerts. I mean, once or twice a summer, I'm up there. I used to take my son traditionally. My son's 37 now. But when he was a boy, we would go up and see the Hershey Bears play. And a little anecdote about me, Gary. So I off air, you were a Washington Post reporter in the mid 80s. I was a Baltimore Sun reporter in the late 80s, and my beat was the Baltimore Skipjacks with Gene Ubriaco and you know, a lot of, and then they became the Caps affiliate for 3 seasons. But I spent Hershey, we played them 7 times up there and 7 times down here. I probably saw 100 hockey games at the Hershey Park Arena in my life, maybe even more. Like, I'd have to really think about it. And it's such a magical little place. Like, for anybody who's been, if you've ever been in that place, and especially now that the new arenas, I was at Staples Center, Crypto, whatever it was, at the Super Bowl a couple weeks ago. And, you know, and I saw John Mayer at Madison Square Garden last week. I'm going to Raleigh this week to see the Eagles. I like hockey rinks, but there's something about the Hershey Park Arena that looks like it's out of a movie set, like literally, right? Like, it looks like it's out of Slapshot or something. And I know Slapshot was shot in Western Pennsylvania, but that arena has some sort of magic and allure and still standing, and it's at the foot of the amusement park. You know, when Springsteen's on stage, he refers to it, and because it's Wilt scored 100 there, and it's almost like they should never rip it down because of that or something, right?
Yeah, you know, Wilt was born in 1936, and so was Hershey Arena. It opened in 1936, and that was the part about working on this book on Wilt's 100-point game that was so magical. You know, I mean, this didn't happen in Philadelphia. This didn't happen in Detroit or Cincinnati. It happened in Milton Hershey's utopian company town. And I spent a lot of time in Hershey.
Was there an amusement park? It had to have been, right? Because I think of the old rides. I'm thinking, what was there in 62? I came into it in the 70s, so there was Super Duper Looper. But the Comet had been there forever. So, like, I'm thinking the Comet was there in 1962, you know, as far as rides. It was an amusement park before Disney had dreamed up Disney, literally.
Right. And so you may remember when Wilt scores 100 points, all the chocolate factory workers, kids bust onto the court, surround Wilt, slapping him on the shoulder, pulling at his wrist. And one boy, a 14-year-old kid named Kerry Ryman, grabbed the ball and started running away with it. You know, and he's being chased by two Hershey constables who aren't exactly trained, you know, for this kind of thing. And they aren't going to catch him. He zigzags across the court. He goes bounding up the arena steps, past the refreshment stand and out into the cold night. March 2nd, 1962. He's breathing. Smoke is like coming from him. It looks like from the cold air. And he goes past the Comet, through the amusement park, and he runs home. And he lives at 50 West Chocolate Avenue. You can't make this stuff up. He says, Mom.
It sounds like a Willy Wonka tale, right? I mean, it does, right?
It does. So he says, Mom, Wilt Chamberlain just scored 100 points at the arena, and I got the ball. And she looks at him and says, give the ball back. You know, and 37 years later, after Wilt died of a heart attack at the age of 63, he and a friend put it on the auction block. It sold for $551,000. But then a controversy broke out. Harvey Pollack, the legendary statistician for the Philadelphia Warriors and then the 76ers, said, no, that's not the ball. We took that ball out of play. So Leland's Auction House in New York suspended the auction pending further review. They reviewed it. I mean, this ball, the kid, Kerry Ryman, started playing with it the next day. There was no such thing as a sports memorabilia market. The thing looked like it had been in a vat of Hershey's chocolate for 37 years. It didn't look like it.
No, and he's also a kid. If he's 14 years old, he's born in 1948. Maybe this is where I could just interrupt the story for a second and ask you where the NBA was at this point, because my first question 60 years later is, why were the Philadelphia Warriors playing in the middle of Hershey, and why did the Knicks come? And this sounds to me like an early, and, you know, and I knew Art Modell well. Art Modell would put on these college doubleheaders. I mean, he's a promoter, right? I mean, like, literally, he had a rink that had a hockey team that he was promoting a game. But was this a one-off, or did they ever play other games there? Because when I did some research on the Bullets a million years ago, when the Bullets were the Bullets, I realized they played like half of their games for 1 year at College Park, that there was a little bit of a barnstorming thing going on with the NBA where the Omaha and the Kansas Cities and the Buffaloes, they were all sort of vying. It wasn't great business basketball in the 60s, right? 1962, that they would bring a game to Hershey. I guess Wilt Chamberlain was a little bit of an Andre the Giant, like, come see the circus, like, a little bit, maybe.
Maybe, you know, they were trying to grow new fans. The NBA, when you think about the NBA of that year, you got to put away the notions of today, the glitz, the glamour, the exploding lights. This was a lounge act in search of itself. And what they were doing is playing games in outlying areas, trying to grow new fans. The Lakers, the only team west of St. Louis at that time, only nine teams in the league. They played a game in San Francisco and Seattle. The Philadelphia Warriors played three games that year in Hershey. This was the 75th game of the season. Didn't mean a thing. No New York sports writers came down to cover the Knicks, who were a last place team. and this thing played out. But, you know, the crowds were so small.
So the Knicks were really bad, too. That's something I didn't know that.
It's like when Kobe scored 81. It was against the last place.
And this was the end of their season at this point. They were about to be. This is when the playoffs happened in April, right? Because they wanted to get it done for baseball season.
Yeah, but not to diminish this too much, Nestor, because Wilt did average 50 points a game that year. 43 games, he scores more than
50. Did he ever score 72 or 79? No, 78, right?
78.
78, okay. 78
that season in triple overtime. And when you score 78, it's kind of like you start thinking, well, if three or four of those finger rolls had gone in,
you'd have 90.
Free throws, you're into the 90s, and then all bets are off.
Gary Pomerantz is here. He once wrote a book on Will Chamberlain. He's a great guest. Where do you reside? I never ask you that. Where are you today?
San Francisco, CA.
Ah, man. Get over to Tommy's. Get yourself a wet margarita over there in Richmond District on Gary. See my pal over there. The book is now 17 years old. The story is 60 years old. When I was trying to think about what I was going to talk about in this and knowing some people that had been there, I knew there was a Baltimore angle. For a moment, I thought that Charlie Ekman may have been the referee. Charlie refereed, and Charlie was a Baltimore legend, you know, like sports radio legend, handicapper legend. He was the Zollner Pistons and the Fort Wayne Pistons head coach back in the 50s when, you know, the NBA was fledgling to be kind, I guess, at that point. He wasn't. I mean, I found the box score, and I sort of thought, but there is a Baltimore angle to this, right? It's something to do Colts, and tell me what the Baltimore part of this was.
So back in those days, they played preliminary games, and they did that to draw fans. In some cases, the preliminary game was bigger than the NBA game, especially when the Harlem Globetrotters were there. They put the Globetrotters second and the NBA games first. And, you know, Bob Cousy from that day told me a story about how deflating it was to hear the roaring of the crowd during the Globetrotter game, then to come out and everybody was gone.
As a kid, I loved Meadowlark and Curly came into the studio and in the day and all that. And it really, like, I wish I could sit around with somebody sharp from that era and see, you know, the late, great Bob Ferry, those kinds of people that were around Lockery, people I knew, and say, if the Globetrotters went on the floor with the 65 Knicks, what would it have looked like? You know, like a real game, not a shoot game, not a confetti game, not any of that. Because those guys could really play, but there was, to your point, 1962, it was milk the cow, sell some tickets, sell some chocolate. You know, the Hershey had chocolate he wanted to sell. These fellas had some basketball they wanted to play, and some people came in off the farm to watch the exhibition, maybe. Yeah?
Yeah, that Baltimore connection was the Baltimore Colts against the Philadelphia Eagles. And I remember
In a basketball game.
They got paid 50 bucks, beer money, basically.
Well, this was March, right? So it was off season for them, right? Okay.
Correct.
And it was an appearance fee, kind of, right?
Jurgensen had been a pretty good college basketball player. He could play. And I remember talking to Gino Marchetti of the Colts. And Gino told me that every time he looked at Wilt, he just thought, what a great tight end he would have made for the Colts. And so Gino's watching this game. And at the end of the third quarter, Wilt's at 69 points. Gino doesn't care. Gino leaves and goes to Martini's Bar in Hershey. And only later, when the guys start showing up after the game, does he find out that the Big Dipper had gone for 100.
Gino Marchetti walked out of the Wilt game?
Yes.
See, this is when I had Marchetti. You know, like, these are the things I have to talk to the old timers about. Was Art Donovan there somehow?
I don't think so.
Art was probably eating bologna somewhere.
Here's another Baltimore connection. Ernie Accorsi, right?
Ernie was there?
Well, here's the story. Ernie was from Hershey, is from Hershey.
I know. Yeah, okay.
And Ernie had been an usher during high school at the Hershey Arena. He'd seen Will play and everything. He's at Wake Forest in his freshman year in his car coming back from the ACC tournament with his fraternity brothers. And he hears on the car radio, Hershey, Pennsylvania. And he says to his buddies, shh, shh, shh. And Ernie's got this sense of dread. The chocolate factory must have blown up. What else could put Hershey on the map here? And when he hit, it's even worse. Will Chamberlain scored 100 points tonight at the Hershey Arena. And Ernie is incredulous. He's speechless. He gets back home and he calls home collect. And his mom answers, says hello. Says, Mom, was Dad there? And there was a pause and she said, I'll let you speak to him. And he was there. He had been at the
His dad
went, but Ernie was devastated that he'd missed it. The greatest night in Hershey sports history, and he missed it.
Well, you know what? The next time I see Ernie, and Ernie's a friend, like a lifer friend, I knew there was a whole bunch of people in my life, as I said, when this piece got offered to me. Gary Pomerantz is here. He's written a book on World Champions. 60 years on March 2nd at the Hershey Park Arena, and anything that makes me talk about the Hershey Park Arena, I get all wistful and, you know, think about my youth, and I hear the blades of the skate, and I hear that song that they would play when Hershey would score in the Hershey Park Arena. Gary, for the legend of this and you writing a book about it, and, you know, Wilt had some other legendary stories about scoring as well during his lifetime. But you wrote this. Wilt was alive when you wrote this, right?
No, I started this actually a few years after Wilt died. He died at the age of 63 in 1999. And you're right.
What made you pick this up then?
When I was a kid, I was growing up in L.A., and I saw this old muscled up guy playing for the Lakers wearing the yellow headband. He was a defensive guy, the specialist, rebounder. And I'm thinking, this guy scored 100 points a game? Impossible. Well, it was years later when I went after it, and I wanted to try to bring it back vividly on the page so it lived again. And it was like raising a galleon from the ocean floor. You know, I loved working on this story. You know, Wilt, for the longest time, did not embrace this 100-point game. He thought it fed the notion that he was an individualist. And it did, of course. But as he got older, he started to realize that's what people identified him for. You know, as the great Boston Red Sox Ted Williams used to say, when I walk down the street, I want people to point at me and say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived. Wilt came to realize that when he walked down the street, people pointed at him and said, there goes the guy who scored 100 points in a game. He did have this Goliath syndrome. You know, he was 7'1", and he had to be even taller, even bigger, more outsized. And when he died, the shorthand summary of his life was two numbers, 20,000 and 100. The 20,000, of course, for his late in life boast that he'd slept with 20,000 women, and the 100 for the 100-point game in Hershey. You know, Wilt created those numbers. And, you know, he sort of fused myth and reality. And if one could be proven and the other couldn't, you know, so be it. And as he wrote in his book, that at my age equals out to having had sex with 1.2 women a day, every day since I was 15 years old. And then he's on book tour in 1991, telling this story when Magic Johnson comes out as HIV positive and Wilt becomes the symbol for the oversexed athlete. But this is Wilt fusing myth and reality, this larger than life quality.
I gave it Bunyan early on. Gary Pomerantz is here. Did you ever meet Wilt, cover Wilt? I mean, you said you were in L.A. and he's wearing the headband, and I remember the old basketball card in the early 70s as well. And, you know, sort of the pop culture talk show actor, you know, showing up kind of cameo Wilt and his palatial palace overlooking Hollywood and, like, you know, all of that lifestyle stuff that came later for him, but from the basketball perspective, you were a sports writer. You missed all that time, right? You didn't talk to him as a sports writer, did you?
Never talked to Wilt. I certainly reviewed a lot of tapes of Wilt talking about himself over and over and over again. But, you know, part of it is if a guy scores 100 points, he's got a need to do it. He's got to not just want to do it, but need it on a deeper level to prove that he can bend a team, really an entire sport, to his will. The other thing that is little considered about this is that for a guy to score 100 points in a game, his teammates have to go along with it. They have to be willing accomplices. They got to give up the ball. They got to subvert their ego. And, you know, this is 1962, the heart of, you know, Dr. King's Black freedom struggle and the movement of which Wilt was really not an active part, as Bill Russell was. Wilt would later call himself the world's tallest Republican. You know, nothing happens in a vacuum, including this. It's interesting to consider that, you know, really this was a symbolic act. It was filled with symbolism. You know, as Babe Ruth's called shot in a 32 World Series is remembered, it's because it was the Depression and America needed heroes. And when Jesse Owens wins the four golds in the 36 Olympics in Berlin with Adolf Hitler watching, he explodes the notion of Aryan superiority. And now Wilt's 100-point game in Hershey symbolically blew apart the racial quota that limited the number of black players to just a few per team. The NBA would be a white man's enclave no more.
Gary Pomerantz is here. He wrote a book about Wilt a number of years ago, 1962. You can go check it out. The Night of 100 Points and the Dawn of a New Era, and kind of piecing it all together as a sports writer. Hey, man, peace out to San Francisco with you. I am sitting on two Pearl Jam nights in Oakland whenever they put the band back together. So a place that I saw the Warriors play many nights, even saw Zeppelin get back together there one night.
You know, Nestor, I want to say one thing. You mentioned Steph Curry. You know, what a joy he is to watch. And I was at the game a few years ago when Klay Thompson scored 60, and he didn't even play the fourth quarter. And here's what I remember from that night, not Klay Thompson. I remember Steph Curry, because it was a blowout game and Steph's on the bench. Every time Klay scoring, and he was a catch and shoot master that night, bam, 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 three, three, three. Steph is waving his towel, high-fiving people on the bench, dancing around. And I'm thinking, what a consummate teammate. And I think that's what Wilt would have wanted for himself later in his career. He led the league in assists, and he crowed, it was like Babe Ruth leading the league in sacrifice bunts. Wilt was a complicated guy, but this night in Hershey belonged to him.
Well, I tip my cap to you for speaking to so many people to have their recollections. And the Ernie Accorsi story was brilliant. I appreciate you coming on. Good luck with the continuation of the book. What do you do these days besides talk about Wilt?
Well, I'm doing a lot of that with the anniversary tomorrow. I teach at Stanford University in the graduate program of journalism.
Nice. Oh, the good stuff. All right. Well, I'll have you back if you'll have me back. And I appreciate you coming back and being a part of the program today. It's great having you on, Gary.
Great to be on. Thanks so much.
I feel so professored. It's good, man. See, I feel like I went to Stanford for the last 20 minutes. Free charge. They charge more than that on campus. I know they do. I've ridden through there before in Palo Alto. I am Nestor. We're having wise conversation, just like the one we just had with Gary Pomerantz about his Wilt Chamberlain book. Luke is monitoring all things NFL Combine as well as the draft. We're kind of getting ready for all of that and figuring out what in the world baseball is doing. I am Nestor. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, getting the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road this week, presented by the Maryland Lottery. We'll be telling you all those dates right if we bring you more at BaltimorePositive.com.